10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
The new member was told that he had eaten the flesh of a human being, and that act had set the final seal on his membership of the Leopard Society. But we see time and time again that these cannibalistic, ritualistically cannibalistic or vampiric cults and societies, they are feasting most of the time on helpless young. There were stories of the Wendigog, basically the origin of the word Wendigo, and these were cannibals, and this was considered at one point to be an imaginary race that was said to inhabit an island in Hudson's Bay, who were of gigantic dimension and extremely given to cannibalism. Science becomes a mark of progress. Science becomes the new belief set.
You have entered the 21st century dystopian portal. Welcome to confusion. Welcome to question. And welcome to clarity. The life is in the blood.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the 21CD podcast. As always, I am your ghost, John. I want to give you guys a reminder that the website is up. There is merch on the site, 21cdstudios.com. You can also send me your stories there if you want to be featured on the show. Also, please don't forget to like, follow, subscribe, hit the little bell on YouTube and the 5-star on Spotify. You guys are absolutely killing it lately. I cannot thank you guys enough for all of the help that you have been giving me lately on growing this channel. I have memberships open as well on YouTube now. If you want to become a paid member, I have 3 different tiers where I give you pretty fun little extras, including lives. I'm going to have live streams. We're also going to have live chats. You get your own icon, different updates about the show, random uploads, more video content, stuff like that. And also, I'm just freaking poor, guys. I'm a writer. This is what I do for a living, and times are definitely hard. So I'm not out here trying to milk anybody for all they're worth, but I am letting you know that I would love to have dental insurance one of these days, and I'm broke. So everything you do keeps the show online and eliminates the risk of me having to lower my involvement in the show so that I can go drive a semi-truck or do something else, whatever I'm capable of doing that would take my attention away from the show. Thank you so much for everything. Without further ado, let's get into it. Believe it or not, there are many reasons for mankind to engage in cannibalism. You have the 4 basic motives: human flesh eaten for food, as some kind of religious rite, maybe for superstition, and then, of course, for vengeance. For food, we're talking about out of starvation, such as the rugby team that was stranded in the Andes, the shipwrecked guy who eats his buddy, etc., etc. When it comes to religion, we can talk about the ancient Aztecs, we can look at communion. Superstition is going to be things like maybe some of the Native American tribes or some of the lesser known cultures that thrived in faraway regions would engage in. And then, of course, for vengeance, as is the case in some serial killers and those who have a sort of bloodlust inside of them. All of these have been mingled in the practice of eating human flesh together or taken independently of each other. It will continue forever and ever and ever because these are essentially things of the human nature itself. These components that lead to cannibalism are the things that make a human in the first place. So, what is the answer to truly ridding ourselves of cannibalism and vampirism? Do we follow the gun control argument? And we get rid of religion so that there is no need to consume another human being for religious purposes, to satisfy some god or to perform some ritual? Or do we just get rid of all of the people who have engaged in cannibalism so that their habits, their spiritual inclinations, their superstitions, or their crazy desires don't impact the rest of us? Like termites, do we just hit the whole hive? Or has mankind evolved in such a way that it is almost impossible at this point to rid ourselves of cannibalism because of the way that science is moving, where we find every possible way to use our fellow man's bodies, dead or alive, to sustain our own survival and satisfy our own hunger, especially at the elite levels? I think to answer this question, we need to take a look at where cannibalism came from, how it originated, and we also need to come to a very intimate understanding of where exactly cannibalism is at today. What level of cannibalism do we engage in? The longer you look, the more you will realize that it appears that each and every one of us could at any moment engage in the act of cannibalism unbeknownst to ourselves, without even knowing. Because it is so very deeply involved in our society, even as modern human beings. The Leopard Societies of Sierra Leone. So small in comparison with the vast area of Nigeria that it is almost lost between French Guinea and the Ivory Coast, nearly in the westernmost curve of West Africa, is the Protectorate of Sierra Leone. Here, the tribes are naturally less scattered. There is a greater homogeneity. Communications are less difficult. Today, like Nigeria, it is rapidly taking a more and more important place in the list of exporting countries, with its resources of iron ore, palm kernels, and cocoa, and more valuable, if on a smaller scale, diamonds and gold. But only yesterday, or perhaps the day before, it was the home of the dreadful leopard societies. One of the very few examples where cannibalism has come to be so highly organized, so close-knit in its ceremonials and taboos, that it has acquired a name, and a name which those who understand its connotations can hardly hear without shuddering. The leopard societies of Sierra Leone existed within the memory of living man. Indeed, there are those who suspect that even now the tradition is not entirely dead. For by very long tradition, members of the exclusive leopard societies were privileged people, like the Hamatsa or the Kwakiutl'd Indians. They had rights over their fellow man that could not be called in question. They were, so to speak, a trade union, and a powerful one at that. Furthermore, they had agents or branches of their trade union tucked unobtrusively into communities and settlements, both large and small, among the mountains, on the plains, on the riverbanks, in the forests, and scrub throughout the land. There was a sort of Freemasonry about their organization that was a terrible, terrible thing. Since the members of the leopard societies were privileged men, no women were included, there was keen competition for membership. And since competition was keen, conditions of membership, and above all the initiation rites, were harsh and forbidding. A man had to pay dearly for membership. Any native of Sierra Leone who desired to become a member of the leopard society, to become, that is, a leopard man, had first to ascertain who the nearest king or priest of the cult might be. Having found and identified him, not necessarily an easy matter, he had to approach him and humbly ask him for Borfamor, a word best translated by the word medicine, but in the sense of the corresponding word, medicine man. He would be told that the king, or priest, had not the absolute power of decision in this matter, but that there were others to be consulted. If the candidate for membership were approved, then a message would come to him that he was to take a certain road or track through the forest where he would meet the Borfamor. Having set out along the track, he would in due course encounter a group of men who would ask him if he was looking for the Borfamor. He would naturally answer that he was, whereupon he would be asked what he wanted the medicine for. There was a traditional answer to this formal question, an odd sort of reply which has no obvious explanation. To play Jagai, he had to reply. And this would be mentioning a traditional West African game that is played with cowrie shells and roughly resembles knuckle bones. If his reply was acceptable, he was then called upon to swear, and after that, there was no turning back. The whole party would proceed along the track through the forest or the bush, coming, as if by chance, upon a red box, in which the Borfamor had already been placed. The candidate for membership was then given a leopard knife. The leopard knife varied slightly in detail, but was in essence a very terrible weapon. It might be a sort of pronged knife with a double point, or a double knife with two prongs each. The prongs or blades were double-edged, and in some cases were set at an angle to the part that was gripped by the user. Whatever their form, they were murderous weapons. Having received the leopard knife, the candidate for membership held it firmly and tapped on the side of the red box containing the Borfamor. As he did this, he repeated an oath. I come now to get this medicine from these people. After this, if I reveal any secret or betray any fellow member, then as I walk along a track, a snake shall bite me. As I go on the sea, my canoe shall overturn and drown me. In the open places when I walk, the lightning shall strike me dead. When the oath had been administered, the party broke up and separated for a space of 3 days. Then they met once more to seek a victim. But before setting forth on their quest, they took a meal together, prepared and served by the men who had met the candidate and admitted him to membership. After the meal was ended, the new member was told that he had eaten the flesh of a human being, and that act had set the final seal on his membership of the Leopard Society. Originally, the victim had to be a girl, freeborn, as opposed to being the daughter of a slave or captive, and over 14 years old. If possible, she should be the eldest child of the family providing her. Each initiate of the Leopard Society had to produce as a sacrifice one person of his own blood, or, failing that, of the blood of his wife's family. In more recent years, the victim could be a woman or a girl, a man or a boy, though still the eldest girl was preferred. Before the killing of a victim, the medicine could be started by putting into the box pieces of the flesh of a newborn child who had died at birth, together with certain other ingredients. But it was held by the members of the society that a medicine made in this way was useful only as a temporary measure. It had no real power as a Borfamor. Two established members of the society accompany the initiate on his quest for a victim. Their object is to beg for a victim, but the form which the begging takes admits of no argument. The group, consisting usually of 5 men, meet the mother or guardian of the intended victim in a lonely place, and they speak to her of the necessity of the sacrifice for the well-being of the tribe. Or it may be that it is a father or brother who is approached and asked for a son or brother. Traditionally, the man or the woman refuses, but half-heartedly only. They know that the Leopard Society has singled them out as a tool, and that to refuse to cooperate would mean more sacrifices, including themselves. By cooperating, they become agents of the society. When the victim has been agreed upon and offered, the leopard men disperse into the forest or bushland. There they wander about all through the succeeding night, imitating the roar of the true leopard, and only ceasing to roar when the first light of day begins to penetrate the trees. This roaring has to be maintained throughout the whole period leading to the actual capture of the victim and during the ceremony of killing or sacrificing the victim as well.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
The next stage is the selection of a member of the society whose strength and animal agility have long been recognized. It is he who is to capture the intended victim. He bears a title, Yangalado, Man with Teeth and Claws. He is equipped with a leopard skin and a pair of leopard knives. The leopard skin is kept by the chief man of the society and is never handled by anyone except himself and the Yangalado, except on this special occasion. Secrecy surrounds every detail of the procedure. The skin, rolled round and containing the knives, is handed, under cover of darkness, from the chief man of the society to a trusted lieutenant. From him, it passes to another, and another, and another, so that no member can say either from whom he received it or to whom he handed it on, until at last it comes into the hands of the Yangalado. The Yangalado puts on the leopard skin and looks about him. He may find that other members of the society have joined him, also wearing some part of the insignia of the leopard. Their faces, like his, will now be covered with the leopard's mask, and they will all be holding leopard knives in their hands, protruding through the ends of the skins like great claws. In many parts of the hinterland of Sierra Leone, the forest, or at any rate the bush, came, and sometimes still comes, to within a matter of yards of the outer huts of any settlement. The leopard men approach to the fringe of the undergrowth and make their sinister whistling cry. The headman of the village recognizes the whistle, and he and any leopard men in the village leave their huts and go out to meet the others in the darkness. Before leaving the village, they have arranged that the victim shall be set on a track that leads into the undergrowth, for traditionally the capture and sacrifice must take place in secret and in darkness. The leopard men lie concealed on each side of the track until a favorable moment arrives. The victim, a man, a woman, or more probably a girl or a boy, approaches. The track lies among thick undergrowth beneath heavy trees. Creepers hang down from the trees and intertwine at head height. The scrub to the left and to the right of the track is as impenetrable as a wall. The night is thick, the air is heavy with the menace of jungle life. The victim is allowed to pass the first of the leopard men, those who have joined in the expedition, perhaps from other villages. She, for it is usually a girl, perhaps slows down her walk a little, for the track she is following is crooked and tortuous, difficult even for her accustomed feet to follow. But in the darkness, even her slightest, hesitant movements can be seen by the men lying in wait till the moment arrives which they judge to be the right one. At last, it is the moment. The silence of the sleeping jungle is broken by a deep-throated growl. The intended victim pauses in her tracks, and at that moment, the Yangalado springs from his hiding place close alongside. He leaps on the back of his victim and in one swift movement tears open her throat. This is the signal for the other leopard men to close in. In between them, they carry their victim further into the bush or forest. As they do so, one of their number, especially appointed for the purpose and shod with pieces of wood carved to represent the paw and claw marks of a real leopard, set to work to make as many leopard tracks as possible, and all forming a trail running into the trees in a different direction from that taken by the main party. When the young Galato has reached an agreed spot at a clearing among the trees and bush, he throws the body to the ground. The lower part of the belly is cut across with a sharp-bladed knife, and the cut is continued up each side of the body as far as the collarbone. The flesh is lifted and the entrails carefully examined. The liver, heart, and intestines are then removed, and the head is hacked off. The body is then divided horizontally at the waist and lengthwise from the neck to the crotch. The four quarters thus produced are further subdivided and the smaller portions systematically distributed. Each portion is quickly wrapped in banana leaves. The face is cut away from the head so that the victim cannot be identified by anyone who has not already become privy to the secret. The liver is the most important part of the victim to be removed from her body. It is this which enables the leopard men to know whether their next borfamor or medicine will be a powerful one. If the liver is as it should be, then the whole of the victim is suitable for their purposes. But the gallbladder, too, must be very carefully scrutinized, for they believe that if the victim has, before her death, been involved in any form of witchcraft, this will be revealed by the condition of her gallbladder. The ritual of slaughter and subsequent examination of the victim's corpse varies among the different sects of leopard men. In the case of one society, the victim was immediately killed, but was forced to sit down on the ground beneath a tree. The chief for whom the particular sacrifice had been planned as representative of his people, whose welfare needed this additional stimulus, then came forward and sat astride the victim's shoulders. The others then came forward, and as many as could do so laid a hand either on the chief or on the victim, and those who could not do so laid a hand on each other so that all were making a chain of contact. The young Galato then prayed that good medicine should come of the sacrifice, and then came forward and in the customary manner tore out the victim's throat. Next, the belly was opened in the usual manner, a bowl placed beneath it to catch the spilled blood. An assistant thrust his hand deep into the belly and quickly tore out the liver and intestines. Another then thrust in his hand and tore away some fat. When the blood had ceased to flow and the bowl was full, the intestines, the liver, the fat, and the blood were taken away to a hut. The victim herself, who might still be partly alive in spite of the loss of blood and the agony she had gone through, was then carried to a platform outside the chief's hut and left there, tethered to a post. The following morning, the body was taken back into a secret part of the forest and cut to pieces. The breast was carefully cut away, and some of the ribs removed. This was the chief's portion, and one of his wives would be in attendance to collect the portion and take it away to be cooked for him. The legs were then cut off, opened, and the bones extracted. The head was cut off, skinned, and all its flesh removed. The leg and thigh bones and the skull were then buried under a palm tree. The remainder of the body was then cut into small portions, and in due course, at the bidding of the chief, the people came out to partake of the feast. At his arrival, having had his own meal, he would be presented with the hands and the feet of the victim, which were his also if he chose to exercise his right. By tradition, however, he would hand these special delicacies to minor chieftains in his tribe or others to whom he wished to show some particular mark of favor. There followed a curious piece of ritual which seems to have been peculiar to some parts of Sierra Leone. When the feast was over and everyone had eaten his portion, banana leaves and stalks were cut off and an effigy of the late victim was constructed of them. The effigy was fashioned to a pole and ceremonially dispatched to the village by which the victim had been provided. A small portion of the victim's body was, by a piece of cruel irony, given to the father or mother of the victim, who was traditionally present at the ceremony and had, of course, connived at the sacrifice. A piece of the skin of the victim's forehead was always preserved to be laid over the bor femur, and a piece of the fat of the kidney was set aside to be rubbed on it. Amid such a welter of ritual, it is not easy to decide which, in fact, is the true motive for the killing and eating of a victim. Those who condemn cannibalism outright as a disgusting and inexcusable practice insist that among the tribesmen of Sierra Leone, such slaughters served one purpose only, that of glutting a savage appetite for human flesh. But surely with a ritual so elaborate, even if so fierce and merciless in its detail, there must be more behind it than a mere lust for flesh. Questioned, tribesmen have declared emphatically that their reason for killing and devouring human beings is to create a powerful medicine, the bor femur, which is so jealously guarded, so secretly used. Possession of a powerful bor femur, they claimed, gave them supremacy over other men. Also, it is a power that prevents the white man from knowing everything that we do. I've been studying cannibalism for a very long time. I've written a book about cannibalism. I've been interested in it long before this show, and especially long before I started talking about it on this show. And I think the reason that I've never really opened up about my interest in it and my ideas on it is because cannibalism is taboo. And the excerpt that I just read you comes from one of the first books written in English about cannibalism as a whole. So it's a pretty interesting process trying to navigate this treacherous sea upon which you cannot show too much interest in cannibalism without being looked at sideways, but simultaneously you must navigate to understand the nature of man, the nature of Nephilim, and the nature of why man is the way he is, why the lack of appreciation for life has grown so severe, and what man hopes to gain from the consumption of his fellow human being. And I think one of the ideas that has been majorly propagandized is that the only people who were ever eaten really were eaten for survival or because they had some kind of power that the consumer hoped to gain from them, because there was some kind of conflict or fight that existed between the two beings, and by eating the other one, you consumed his strength, you consumed his power, and that made you a more powerful being because you absorb their power, and that power somehow is as strong or stronger than yours, and now you are doubly strong. But we see time and time again that these cannibalistic, ritualistically cannibalistic or vampiric cults and societies, they are feasting most of the time on helpless young or helpless individuals who don't seem to have much power except for the fact that they are young. And that in of itself is a power of its own, I guess, when you think about it. What do people hope to gain by consuming the young? Everlasting life? Some sort of youthfulness that they can't find in normal life through regular vitamins or supplements? Or is it deeper? Is it spiritual? In my opinion, it goes all the way back to the biblical Nephilim. It goes all the way back to the days of the giants and the fallen angels, and how the Nephilim in those times taught humanity cannibalism, and how the evil beings that walked the planet forced humanity to begin to consume each other. This gradually transformed into the practice of cults and secret societies. It became a rite of passage. It became a type of blackmail, but a spiritual blackmail. You had to prove that you really wanted something. You wanted it really, really badly. And by eating another human being while everybody watches, you will prove your reliability. You will prove your dedication to our cause, to our way of life, to our secrets. Because if you should ever even consider stabbing our back, ratting us out, betraying us, we've already got you. We know what you did. But not only this, they know what you did. The spirit realm that you swore before, the transgressions that you have committed, the sins against God and against your fellow man that you have brought upon yourself compels you to remain committed to whatever society or blood cult you have now enlisted yourself in. So welcome to the fold. You've had to work hard to get here. You had to really prove yourself to us. You had to really dig deep and find the evil within you to commit these heinous and atrocious acts, not only of murder, but then of the desecration of a body. After that, the consumption of a body. This is something of a shackle. You won't be able to shake this. It's also a proverbial flare shot up into the sky of the spirit realm, because they now know what you specifically are capable of. They know the limits you're willing to go to, and they will not leave you alone. That's the power that many of these cults and societies hope to gain. The power that flows from those entities are why they do it. Time and time again, they report seeking out this power, and only through these types of acts do they ever achieve that type of power. Why do you think that is?
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
That's because this is one of the actions. Cannibalism. Vampirism. It is a demonic request. It is a letter from Hogwarts, specifically addressed to them. And they've been invited into the university that is your mind, where they will now become teachers. You've already proven yourself a student who will be worthy of their time, worthy of their teaching. You've done this by acquainting yourself with a sin of paramount consequence. If you did harm to a child, the consequence is even more supreme. The Lord has a very soft heart for children and for the young and for the helpless. And he reserves a very special punishment for those who would harm them. And don't think for a second that this does not come at some cost to them, to the dark ones, to the demons that would seek your attention, because it does. They, when the final judgment comes, will have to pay for all of their transgressions as well. It just so happens that you have now become one of them. And so they want to ensure that if they're going to pay for you, you're going to be worth the cost. They spend human blood quite frivolously. They gorge themselves upon it. They are enriched with human blood. And so one more body to them means nothing. But that is, of course, because they are drunken with it. They get a high off of it. And similarly, interestingly enough, humans do as well. Once you have consumed your first human being, it becomes a bit of a drug. There is a high to it. You do become intoxicated. It becomes easier next time. Bloodlust becomes less of an action of rage and more of a quite literal thirst. But it's not always as simple as being jockeyed by some demon randomly or falling into a cult. Combining the spiritual aspect with the easiness of the act of cannibalism turns one into a bit of a vampire. And that can happen to you even against your will or even without you knowing that it's happening. It's important to know that the roots of this stuff and the details of different religious characteristics that lead one to a sustained level of cannibalism are important and critical to the type of cannibalism that is being committed. What is religious in a culture ultimately determines the moral compass of pretty much everybody that is inside of that culture, even if they're not particularly religious themselves. We see proof of that in atheists. They know that murder is bad, and this is mainly because in most religions, especially the religions of their country, whatever country that is, most of the time they forbid murder. The moral compass is either spiritual guidance, and for good or bad, it determines where your moral compass leads you, or it's religious residue, even if you don't believe in that God that that religion worships. This is also why so many seculars preach a separation of church and state. In a way, it removes the freedom of choice. It removes the power of conscience, and it essentially shapes culture according to the echo chamber of the religion. Let's look at the ancient Aztecs for a second. We know that human sacrifices were introduced in Anahuac about 2 centuries before the advent of the Spaniards, and we can pretty much assume that cannibalism must have originated either shortly before or immediately after the institution of certain religious festivals, which of course followed some kind of spiritual awakening, even if that awakening was into darkness. That is essentially where it seems in this particular culture and in many others that cannibalism came from. And we find a constant relation between these religious and spiritual actions and the hideous vice that we're dealing with, cannibalism. But it's interesting to note that as a rule, only prisoners of war were sacrificed in places like the Aztec Empire, as far as we know, and consequently, only such were eaten. It is, however, a fact that wars were literally engaged with the sole objective of obtaining prisoners for sacrifice on their altars and for consumption. So the number of victims annually sacrificed in Montezuma's empire is given by historians, and it varies between 20 and 70,000 people annually. So that's quite a bit of people that are being sacrificed and consumed, and it really just goes to show you how powerful the Aztec Empire was and why a belief such as this might continue, a belief that cannibalism leads to greater power. It did seem like the more that they ate of their fellow man, the stronger they were. And this goes back to another concept that we're going to talk about eventually, which is the fewer people there are, the harder it is to starve to death. But I digress. About 40 years before the conquest, when the great temples began to fall, their terrible god of war was inaugurated. And from 70 to 80,000 victims, according to different accounts, including those of ancient Aztec chroniclers, were sacrificed and subsequently consumed within a few days. The Franciscan Torquemada says that 72,344 enemies were sacrificed, and the Aztec writer, whose name I cannot pronounce, Ixtlilxochitl, is his history of Chichimecas raises this number to 80,400 people sacrificed in this two-day period. Cortez's soldiers discovered 136,000 skulls in one single building, arranged and embedded in the walls in absolutely perfect order. And in every single town of New Spain, which is what they called this place, they found prisoners who were destined for sacrifice. So, according to several descriptions, the body of the victim was, after the heart had been torn out, that's like the real sacrifice, the body would be delivered to the captain or the soldier who had taken him prisoner. And the warrior then invited all his friends and their relations and provided a feast out of it. Bernal Diaz states that after removing the heart, the priest cast the bodies down the steps of the pyramids, and the mob then and there would sometimes cut them to pieces, leaving only the entrails and the bones for the vultures. Both accounts may be correct. The former would apply when a single victim or a few were being dealt with, and the latter when the hecatombs of hundreds or thousands of enemies were offered up. So you see this cultural drawing toward cannibalism. Even if each individual little citizen of the Aztec Empire doesn't have a real reason to commit cannibalism, it is a spiritual drawing. It is a calling of the culture due to religious beliefs. The connection of cannibalism with these religious ceremonies has been widely demonstrated, but it's not always accompanied by ritualistic observances. So what I mean by that is it is a part of their spirituality, but their spirituality doesn't seem to really require it at very specific times. It's an event that occurs as it is needed or in a way that benefits the kingdom, and they rationalize it, they validate it against their religion, okay? Again, Bernal Diaz, in speaking of Montezuma and his habits, mentions that literal dishes were prepared for the flesh of boys of tender age. He also describes how the Tlaxcalan, who were the allies of the Spaniards during the siege of Mexico City, when relieved and enabled to return to their homes, took loads of human flesh back with them. Thus, if Montezuma and presumably other chiefs as well ate the boys of tender age, these could not have been prisoners taken in battle, or if boys were sacrificed at all. It's evident that in order to supply the emperor or his table with this select meat, they were killed specially for that purpose. So that being said, it wasn't always warriors who were killed in battle. It was sometimes just young people, women, and children, stuff like that. But this was all, of course, a religious belief that formed into a personal habit, a spiritual drawing that evolved into a way of life. Furthermore, we see that the Tlaxcaltecs took loads of human flesh back to their villages, and they would cut up their fallen enemies from the battlefield, and they would even preserve them. They would salt them and smoke the flesh. And all of that occurred without any religious ceremony whatsoever, which just is further evidence that once you start, it's hard to stop, even if it's no longer for any spiritual reasons. It remains to be seen whether a way can be found to explain the extraordinary anomaly of an entire civilized nation given to cannibalism. And as I mentioned before, there are versions of history that teach us that it's born of hunger and want. In present times, we occasionally hear of it being practiced by a shipwrecked crew or a plane-wrecked rugby team in the Andes, or by other, even highly cultured men in similar cases of stress. And as the same causes produces the same effects, we are bound to inquire whether want was not the motive which in the first place drove the Mexicans to feed on the flesh of their own race. We don't really know, but if you are a spiritual person like me, you kind of believe that this came from some kind of fallen angel influence and then continued as demonic influence. Because obviously, you know, I'm a believer in the God of the Christians, and the God of the Christians, even in my version of him, does not allow cannibalism. So that would mean that anything contrary to that is demonic influence. But natives of Central, South, North America, they've all had pretty good knowledge when it comes to what can and can't be eaten in the woods, right? Like what kind of plants are edible and stuff. And they would also know that all animals are good food. So this seems to prove that only famine and some type of total want, total desire, even if spiritually instilled, of meat could have induced men to try to eat themselves, right? And we may further be permitted to then ask, without the slightest idea of blame for the heroic conquerors, if by identical causes they were not themselves misled into cannibalism. It was some kind of misleading. We know from their own reports that after the battle, they searched for the fastest dead Indians and secured their grease, which they employed as ointment in curing their wounds and the wounds of their horses. By butchering for grease, they engaged in activities of cannibalism regardless. Without consuming them, they used the human body as an ointment, as a cure for some kind of ailment, for wounds. They used the human body for their own bodily gain, and that is cannibalism. It doesn't just have to be consumption. If your body is absorbing that of another, you are engaging in cannibalism and in vampirism, as a matter of fact. And you know, people of the time who had respect for the human body, for human life in general, they didn't engage in these types of activities. So this was something that is indicative of a demonic influence. If you're asking somebody like me, and if you're watching this video, you must be. And I wish that I could say that this was something of the past, that this was something that only quote-unquote savage peoples or uncivilized people, which is not my words for it, by the way. These are just the people as they've been called at that time. I'm not calling them savages. I'm not calling them people who are uncivilized, because clearly they had one of the greatest civilizations on the planet. These are just the words that have been used to describe them, because the modern man, the modern spiritual leaders, the modern governmental leaders, they have to make sure that there is a clear distinction between these quote unquote savages and these new types that we have now, where we are still trying to use the human body to sustain our own. We are still trying to use the bodies of the dead to sustain our own. And we do this through things like adrenochrome. We do this through things like stem cells. We do this through many, many, many different ways that are not even told to you. Where do you think all the bodies are going? A lot of that is getting dumped into the food supply. A lot of that is accidentally inserted into, quote unquote, accidentally inserted into the food supply. Unfortunately, we still live in a cannibal society. We have just allowed science and spirituality to redefine cannibalism for us so that we don't feel like we still are. And then we have been indoctrinated over a period of time, just like the ancient peoples were. Until now, it is commonplace. We just call it medicine, or we call it surgery, or we call it injections, or we call it McDonald's. And if there has not been some kind of global apocalypse on par with the great flood of the biblical times, you do have to wonder how and why cannibalism even stopped, if you believe that it actually did. You know, even moving forward into North America, moving upward, I should say, into North America, we have these North American tribes that were engaging in cannibalism on a pretty widespread basis. There were stories of the Wendigog, which is basically the origin of the word Wendigo, and these were cannibals, and this was considered at one point to be an imaginary race that was said to inhabit an island in Hudson's Bay, who were of gigantic dimension and extremely given to cannibalism. The Muskego people, who inhabited the low and cheerless swamps on the borders of Hudson's Bay and other regions, were themselves reproached by the other tribes as cannibals. And even they were afraid of these dreaded Wendigog. And we see time and time again that the Aboriginal people of Mexico and Central America appear to have been far less barbarous than the natives of other parts of North America. Cannibalism existed among them, but it took a sort of religious ceremony. A lot of the time in these later days. I'm not talking about merely just the Aztecs, but some of these other Mexican and Central American cultures. The Aboriginal Mexicans were not cannibals in the coarsest acceptance of the term. They did not feed on human flesh, in other words, just to gratify some kind of brutish appetite, but in a kind of following of a religion, following of a spiritual belief. It all seemed to lead back to an altar somewhere, is what I'm trying to say. And among the New Mexican Indians, that is not the case. Obviously, there were many different tribes in North America, and they differed, and amongst themselves, they had different beliefs as far as when it was okay to eat human flesh. But many did think that human flesh was okay to eat. And we even have examples like the Anasazi people. This entire civilization, one of the biggest civilizations found in North America, quite literally consuming themselves to death or being consumed to extinction by some other race or tribe or being, maybe the Nephilim, the giants who lived here in North America, similar to the Wendigog. The practice of eating human flesh as food in North America could have had its origin in necessity, just like the pre-flood days, eaten to prevent starvation, and then later found to be good, as cannibals affirm that it is, and it may have come to be regarded as one of the regular foods subsequently. The fact of the matter is we just don't have enough historical accounts to really say why Northern Native American tribes were committing atrocious acts of cannibalism in the situations that they did. I'm not saying that every single tribe did this, because that's not true, but several too many did in some form or another. And a lot of the time, like the Iroquois claim that it was for the warriors to eat their enemy warriors that they had killed in battle. But sometimes it appears that humans were literally hunted for food. These tribes would hunt each other and then consume them for survival. And those are the particular situations that remind me of the pre-flood days, where they were pushed to this. And I'm not saying they were pushed to this by colonization. They were pushed to this by something more ancient, something akin to starvation. They saw no other way out, and gradually it became a form of survival for them that they accepted, even after other opportunities such as agriculture and stuff like that arrived into their culture.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Why do you think there's such an appeal for a victim that is willing but must appear unwilling? A victim that is in agreement or has been sold but is aware of the fate that they're about to meet. How does this relate to the vampire needing to be invited in? Or to the mirror that no longer reflects the true self because something else has taken over inside? Something spiritual, something that can't be seen on a physical level. There's also a new acceptance of the hunger for your own kind after you already partake once. You have already stooped so low. You have already convinced yourself that you are capable of doing such a thing. And so next time it will be easier simply because you have already done it. We see this in the case of serial killers, serial cannibalists, and even some Holocaust victims who under some situations had to engage in cannibalism to stay alive, quite literally to sustain their lives while in concentration camps. Upon their rescue, they have been recorded continuing to engage in cannibalism because of this hunger that developed and this sense of need for it that continued to the point where engaging in cannibalism essentially became second nature. It became something that was just generally done, and they forgot how to actually function in a civilized society where cannibalism was no longer allowed. This is essentially a direct echo of the Nephilim way of life, the fallen angel atrocities that were wrought upon the earth prior to the flood. This is one of the reasons that God said that he was ashamed of mankind, is because we resorted to so much cannibalism, so much vampirism, so many of these types of natures that we forgot who we were. We forgot our own kind, and therefore we forgot God. So much so that there was simply no limit to our consumption of each other. We were eating ourselves to extinction. And this is also what happens to the soul and to the human mind, and even to the human body after too much consumption of human flesh. We see a particular gravitational pull toward cannibalism in the between the wars type periods, the periods of time that exist between wars. In the early 1920s, there was a hot dog vendor plying his trade at one of the railroad stations in Berlin, for instance. His name was Grossman, and he had once been a butcher. Grossman was about 50 years old. He was thin. He was an insignificant little man with a haggard face and a sloping mustache. And about twice a month, he used to spend a day on the platform where long-distance, slow trains with cheap fourth-class carriages would stop. And if he saw, getting out of one of those carriages, a girl who looked as if she were coming to the city to perhaps hunt for a job as a housemaid, he would approach her, provided that she was fat enough. He would politely lift his cap and inquire whether he could be of any assistance. And during the conversation, he would drop a remark that he was in need of a housekeeper for his bachelor household, and that she could have the job, if she wanted. He paid well, he used to say, and there was not much work to do. Often a girl accepted, and any who did would not be seen again. Grossman kept each of these girls for a couple of days before murdering her. He would cut up the bodies with a butcher's skill. He kept the flesh and disposed of the balance in some sewer. Then he pickled the meat, he ground it, and he would put it into his sausages, which he later sold at the railway station. This constant stream of girls into his flat finally alerted some neighbors, who put the police on his trail. Bundles of female clothes were discovered in the closets, and finally, Grossman confessed. What we're seeing is an act that arose out of necessity and gradually became habit, to the point where the entire concept that anybody around you might be against this has evaporated from Grossman's mind. He believes that it is not that big of a deal. Perhaps even worse than the cannibalism itself is the murder. But surely nobody will care that much, even if they find out, if I sell my sausages that contain human meat. Grossman has a supply of a certain type of meat, and there is a demand for a certain type of sausage. So if once in a while a certain type of meat ends up in a certain type of sausage, is it really that big of a deal? The people keep buying, they must be enjoying the sausage, they continue to pay me for the sausage, so why would I not continue to supply the sausage? And this goes on for a period of time until it just becomes a process that is done continually without any real regard for what is happening. It moves to the back of the mind that cannibalism is being committed. It moves to the back of the mind because that is what the human mind does. That is how the human mind covers over trauma. That is how it explains itself to its own soul. That is how it excuses itself from abominations. The human mind is extremely elastic. I think that this is intentional. Perhaps it's a product of sin, but I think it is also a safety line that has been given to the human mind so that our own sins do not cause us to literally kill ourselves daily. This is what makes his forgiveness and grace such a mercy. It is noticeable how people who have never been cannibals despise the horrible thing, and how quickly it disappears when a cannibal tribe comes into contact with a wider world that is apart from their mere bush villages. Directly, daylight falls on the habit, and it withers away. Where we find it, we get rid of it. This is remarkable when we remember the sanctity of it in primitive man's eyes, especially considering the Aztecs and people like that. The cannibal is not necessarily a hopelessly degraded brute, but also a man who has not yet lived out of the dark obscurity of bush tribalism, and so has kind of blindly followed a practice that is deep-rooted in the ideas common to man in the position that he lives in this case, common to man the world over from the earliest days. But man always finds a way to return to cannibalism, even civilized man. When trapped at sea, before death, even though death will come, man will resort to eating his brother. And when able to get for a very cheap price at a certain fast food restaurant, because this certain fast food restaurant has a certain type of meat in high supply, and there is a demand for a certain type of burger, therefore the supply and demand routine continues. And we completely forget, or we never even think about what could possibly be in the meat, because why would we? But human meat goes somewhere, my friends, and it's not simply into graveyards. It is into science, it is into chains, it is into food supplies, it is into water supplies. The act of cannibalism in the modern times is so widespread. We could all be considered to be members of some kind of bush tribalism in a concrete jungle. And we should compare ourselves to these types of people, because these types of people do not ask questions about their food supply, about their meat, and neither do we. They, like us, continue to simply eat and eat and eat until we are no longer hungry. But sometimes it gets a little bit more complicated. Obviously, nearly everybody can see how it's an evil thing to take someone against their will, destroy their lives, and then cannibalize them. Koku and Kokan are from pre-modern China. In classical Chinese sources, these acts are more accurately described by the terms gegu, meaning cutting the flesh from the thigh, and gegan, meaning cutting from the liver. They describe situations in which sons or daughters deliberately removed portions of their own flesh and prepared them as medicinal substances for their gravely ill parents. These acts were not understood as surgical procedures or organ donation in any modern biomedical sense, but as moral interventions. The underlying belief was that the human body was essentially a gift received from one's parents, and therefore the highest possible expression of devotion was to return that gift, your body, even in mutilated form, to preserve your parents' life. Over time, this concept was taken hold by religion, and it essentially replaced the scientific aspect of how bad this is for the human body, but this moral framework elevated sacrifice into a form of ethical proof, and it created a narrative economy in which extreme physical suffering could be publicly validated as virtue, even as it contradicted other ethical norms. There's a legend of a princess Miao Shan who represents the mythic culmination of this logic. In the story, her father, often identified as King Miao Chuang in later retellings, falls gravely ill after persecuting religious virtue. Physicians declare that the only possible cure requires medicine made from the flesh of someone completely free of anger or resentment. His daughter, of course, willingly sacrifices her body, some say her hands, her arms, some even say her eyes, to save him. Her act restores his health, and her selfless suffering elevates her beyond the human realm and transforms her into a sort of spiritual figure. Non-consensual cannibalism is, of course, usually preceded by murder, but what exactly are the spiritual connotations of consensual cannibalism, like we've just talked about? What is the ethical difference between consensual post-mortem organ harvesting and consensual post-mortem cannibalism? Why is stem cell harvesting from, let's just say, aborted fetuses morally superior to consensual post-mortem cannibalism? When members of a plane-wrecked rugby team stranded on an inaccessible mountain range in the Andes resort to eating each other in order to survive, we turn a blind eye to their repeated acts of cannibalism and even proclaim them as heroes, in a way. Heroic for what they had to go through. Legends, if you will, for the lengths they'll go to survive. As the auxiliary bishop of Montevideo said after the crash, eating someone who has died in order to survive is incorporating their substance, and it is quite possible to compare this with a graft. Flesh survives when assimilated by someone in extreme need, just as it does when an eye or heart of a dead man is grafted onto a living man. There's an interesting philosophy behind that, if you will. And maybe we'll go over this in another episode on a deeper level, this whole concept of consensual cannibalism, because it is strange, controversial, and it is intriguing. But the majority of cannibalism does not necessarily take place in this way. And I would argue that a lot of quote-unquote consensual cannibalism is not actually consensual. If the individual cannot give consent, that doesn't make you using their dead body consensual. It just means they can't fight back. You are still the one consuming something that was not willingly given to you specifically.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
This goes back to the Nephilim and how they taught people to do this. And over time, the more that one engages in cannibalism, the more it becomes routine. Even if it is a spiritual experience, it's a bit like experiencing a spiritual hunger routinely and satisfying it without much concern for what is actually going on. And when you're God or your deity or whatever it is that you believe in that is actually encouraging such actions spiritually also does not disavow you or frown upon this type of action, it becomes even easier to engage in. It could also be compared to snake oil and the Wild West days when you would find the snake oil salesman who would sell you a vial of something that could cure this ailment, that ailment, or any other ailment under the sun. It's a lot like mumia, the ground up remains of mummies that explorers would sell to Westerners after finding mummies in Egypt because it allegedly was good for you. It allegedly did things to you that made you stronger, more capable. It healed your ailments. It gave you some sort of vitality, etc. Whatever they want to say it was. But enough of this action integrated heavily enough into society, routinely engaged upon, a spiritual matter simply becomes a regular matter. Much like they say a nation is a Christian nation, therefore the laws are generally Christian in nature. A nation that does not expressly forbid cannibalism, even if it does not expressly declare cannibalism a focus of its identity, a founding member of its ideology, will generally grow to accept cannibalism as a regular feature of its society. Unfortunately, in the modern times, cannibalism has been hidden. It has been disguised. Vampirism along with it, they are essentially the same thing. They have been integrated into society in such a way that we don't recognize vampirism and cannibalism as vampirism and cannibalism. And then we can criminalize the discussion of those things online and make it so that every YouTuber who says a certain thing is cannibalism or vampirism, when we don't want people to think of it in that kind of light, gets banned. We can continue in our ways. We can reclassify things essentially at will. And as long as the loud mouths who would speak out against us are silenced, we can elect religious leaders who we believe will properly fill in the blanks for what is not expressly stated in our religious texts, so we know just how far we can probably go in violating our fellow human beings and just how much of them we can consume, or at least how close we can get to consuming them before we go to hell. Eventually, the lingo becomes less about spirituality or religion, and it becomes more about science, and science becomes a mark of progress. Science becomes the new belief set. Science essentially becomes religion and politics and spirituality all lumped into one identity, and that is what runs the world, just as it did in the old days, make no mistake. After all, we're still trying to get to the stars where those abominations came from in the first place. It is all just a big circle going round and round and round. And there are very, very boldly defined places we cannot go, but not so boldly defined places where we can go, as long as we just don't step over this line that our elected leaders have morphed our God into, because we have drifted so far away from the actual right way of things, and we have put the right way of things into the mouths of man so that they can define them for us, because we need to feel good about ourselves at the end of the day. And if you are in charge, then you look down upon these people before you in your society, and you realize how much you need them. You need them to accomplish your goals. You need them to succeed. You need their labor. You need their minds. You need their money. You need them to be convinced that you are the rightful one for power, that you are the one to wield the technology, that you have the invention they need, and you need their time, you need their energy. Without them, you will cease to be what you desire to be. You will cease to be at all, perhaps. You will not be able to accomplish your goals, so you need to provide them with certain answers about spirituality. You need to provide them with answers about how to ascend. You need to provide them with ways to better themselves. You need to provide them with access to God. Through that access, you will have their souls. You will have their hearts. You will have their bodies. And finally, you will be able to manipulate them out of each and every piece and part of them. You will be able to pick them apart. You will be able to stab them with needles. You will be able to experiment and consume to your heart's delight. And it will all be normalized. It will all feel like a typical mundane day. Just a another day of consumption and of consuming. And suddenly, we're right back where we started. The life is in the blood.
My fellow Americans, this July, we're celebrating America's birthday at Moto Casino by giving away $1,776,000 in prizes. And one lucky winner is going to take home $1 million SC. Happy 250th birthday, America. You're welcome. Download Moto Casino today.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.